So good afternoon, everyone. Thanks, Aggie, for asking me to do these two lectures. I'm very excited to teach to a physics audience. It's the first time ever for me. So my name is Debbie Leung. I have been with the Department of CNO and the Combinatorics and Optimization and the Institute for Quantum Computing for 11 years almost. So my work, my own research, is mostly on quantum communication, the theory part. Quantum cryptography, and I did the measurement-based quantum computation and error correcting code before. And I also work on non-local gains and basically any interesting aspect of theoretical quantum information. If I can't stop thinking about it, I end up working on it. So today's lecture is on one specific topic, a very foundational one. We see both the classical and the quantum version of it. So what we want to discuss are notions called typicality. When you have a random process, and that random process is happening repeatedly many times in an independent way, certain things has to happen with high probability, and that's what we mean by typicality. And then we will derive what we call the asymptotic equipartition theorem. We'll see that in gory detail, so don't worry about having an acronym here. That will lead us to consider what is entropy. And note that this entropy is a little different from the entropy typically in physics. It's different from the entropy that you will see in StatMag, for example. I'll make one or two sentences in relating the two things, but this is an entropy that is in the information theoretic sense. And then we'll see how it leads us to methods to do the data compression in the classical setting. Then we'll repeat the whole sequence in the quantum setting. And in the end, if I still have time, for those of you who overheard my discussion, if I'm allowed to overtime, we can see what on earth it has to do with entanglement. Some of you may be very interested in entanglement in general because I think it finds a lot of application elsewhere besides quantum information. And the goal here is really to quantify what is information and what is redundancy. The lectures are heavily based on two lectures in my grad course back in fall. This is the link to the course website. And there are three files total if you're interested. Today's version is a little tweaked here and there, and it's a little shorter. I will skip some of the details. If you want to see more references, Nielsen and Tron session 12.2 cover very similar material. The classical part is one of my favorite books by Tom Kofa and Joy Thomas. Chapter 3 on the classical asymptotic equipartition theorem. And then these are paid. You need to pay for these books. There's a free resource by John Preskill. It's very nicely written too. I'll mention some of the, what's the difference between what you see here and what he has in his book. Chapter 10.1.1, and then there's one section on something else, and then get further to 10.3 and 10.4. That's roughly where the material in other material that I'm aware of. Okay. So let me start. We first talk about what is a random variable. Okay. So most of the time, I'll use a capitalized alphabet for the random variable itself. And a random variable, I'll just say verbally, is a variable whose possible outcome are just numerical outcomes of a random process. We're all familiar with that. Take a coin toss. We call it a coin toss. It's a random variable that has two possible outcomes. It's either head or tail. So there are the set of outcomes that we want to define. So I call it omega. Most of the time, it's called the sample space. It's the set of all possible outcomes of your random variable. In the case of the coin toss, it's the set head and tail in the set. Of course, we can use numbers instead of these events. Now, what is important is that each of these events, possible outcome or event in the sample space, happen with a well-defined probability. So we have a function, p. Random variables can be discrete or continuous. We only consider discrete finite random variables in this lecture. So we can talk about a function. We call it the probability distribution of x. And what it does is it is a function from the sample space to 0, 1. And what what it does is just to give you a probability for every single possible event. That is unambiguous. The probability, of course, has to be between 0 and 1, and then x is taken to the probability of x happening. We need the fact that when we sum over all the events that can possibly happen, the probability should sum to 1. We need that too. So for example, I'll just write it here. For x being a biased coin, we have omega being, I'll call it 0 and 1 instead of head and tail, and say, I'll use an example throughout the lecture that is very biased. You get probability 10% to get, say, 0, and then 90% to be the other possibility, 1, okay? There's so far any question on the definitions or this terminology? Okay, now, the next concept, instead of a discrete, information source, so it's a sequence of random variables, x1, x2, with a common sample space. Oops. And let me just call that omega, okay? Now, where does it arise? For example, I'll just say in words instead of writing on the board. You have a coin, you can toss it as many times as you want. So each coin toss gives you one of these random variable in the sequence. So x1, you can toss it a second time. You can just keep tossing it until you're too tired to go on. So that gives one example why we have this kind of a source that it's just a sequence of these random variables. And each of them has the same format of the outcome. Another one that we're very familiar with is the weather. So the sample space, it can be sunny, it can be cloudy, it can be rainy. In here, it can snow. So there are four things in the sample space, to simplify a little bit. And then every day is a new item. Every day we have one event out of this random variable, and every day we repeat. Okay, so now these two examples shows you that there are sources that are what we call independent and identically distributed, and there are cases in which they need not be independent. The weather is clearly not independent from the one day to the next one. But in the coin toss, if this is if the coin is just loaded, but otherwise you toss it the same way every time, then it's independently distributed. So there are these two separate cases we need to handle. We do not want to discuss the case when it's dependent. So we will focus for the rest of the lecture when the source is independent and identically distributed. Let me just write it clearly once. So only consider independent and identically distributed sources. We just usually say IID like this. And the reason is most of the typicality occur much faster in this case. The fact that they're independent is not necessary. There are tools to handle that in other settings, but we will not see it in this particular two-lecture coverage. Now, the next is the development on... So, which what am I on? Is this fucking... Yeah, I was practicing on this a while, and this is the hardest one. first, let's see why anything along the direction, something very typical has to keep happening. The intuition about typicality here. The AEP throughout. So I'll tell you what to expect first, and then explain why you should expect that. Then we'll come back to prove everything that we say on this board. So we consider n draws in this sequence, this source. So I just put n on the as a superscript, but I have n draws of this IID source, so xi, or distributed according to x, IID. The claim is that if n is large, that's what the asymptotic is for. You can find a large probability set . Let me call it Sn, because it depends on n. In the this is just the same sample space n times, so you have all n tuples of events. You can find this set of events. This set has, first of all, it is most of the event. Like, you can hardly get out of it probabilistically. Second, it has a very peculiar feature. Not only is most of the probability, it also has very low cardinality. There are very few events inside. The third property is that the elements in this set are all roughly equal probable. Elements of Sn have, I'll call similar. We'll see how similar they are, probabilities. That's where the EQ partition comes from, yes?
So the large probability set, by that you mean that the set with elements which have large probabilities, not that the set is large?
The set. When you sum the probability of every element in the set, that probability is close to one. That's what it means. Thank you. Yeah. And the set is small.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of the number of elements in there. Now, it's very counterintuitive. None of this should make reasonable sense. Now, but why we should even expect something like this to happen? So let's see. So consider an arbitrary event, just any of it. I use small alphabet for the event, x1, x2, through xn. In the case of the bias coin, this will be n. N of these bits, some combination of zeros and ones. Now, if we consider the probability of this event, we only know one thing about this distribution. We know that this is IID. So the probability of this event has to be the product that you get the probability of x1 in the first draw multiplied to the probability of second event, x2, in the second draw, all the way through Pxn, just purely out of independence. Okay. Now, furthermore, we can rewrite it slightly. It's a little weird, but we'll do it. You can write it as 2 to the log Px1. Log is base 2 throughout the talk, throughout the lectures here. 2 to the log Px2, and so on. No one prevents us from doing that. The next step is that you can write it as minus n, and then you consider what's left behind. We have 1 over n, sum of I from 1 through n. Now this funny thing, log, I have a minus sign in front, PXI. That's what I have in the exponent. Now, if you stare at what's this object, and imagine now another random variable, consider the random variable minus log P of X, that happens with probability PX. So this is not a new random variable on the set of all possible real numbers. The random variable would take value minus log PX with probability PX. Say for the coin, my random variable have two points in the sample space. It is minus log 0.1, that's one point. There's another thing that is minus log 0.9, that's another event in the sample space. There are two real numbers there. The first one occurred with probability 0.1, minus log 0.9 occurred with probability 0.9, okay? So now we have a new random variable. We draw it n times. We draw minus log px1 with probability px1. We do that for all n of them. We look at the value. We take the average. And that's what goes into the exponent. Now, if we do it large number of times, you expect this is an empirical average of this event. You draw minus log px n times. You write down your outcome. You take the average. With large n, this thing better go to the theoretical average. And the theoretical average is actually 1 over, we don't have 1 over n anymore. We have sum over x, px, minus log p of x. Okay? Any question on this claim? The probability of pxn with large probability should approach 2 to the minus n times this quantity when n is large. So there's very few choices how these probability can behave. They have to be very close to this, and we'll find out how close. From there, we'll find out why this set is so small and how big is this set exactly. I'll tell you it's 2 to the n times this quantity. This is the entropy of the random variable we'll see in the next board. Any question on this? So now let's write down some of the definitions. Sometimes we write the random variable as the argument. Sometimes we write down the probability distribution. For our purpose, there's no difference. And it is minus sum over x in the sample space, p of x, log base 2, p of x. Okay. The unit is in bits. It's already different from what you have in thermodynamics, where you have, I think it's Kb, the Boltzmann constant, times log the number of microstates you can have. Now, they will become the same if your p of x all equals to 1 over the size of the sample space. I forgot to say earlier. Say, without... Whenever I need to, because it's finite, the size of the sample space is n, if I need to. This is the cardinality, or the number of elements in the set. So this will be the, I'll just say on the side, the log x, the entropy of x is log the size of the sample space if p of x are all equal. So they all have to be equal to 1 over the size of the sample space. Okay. In that case, then you get the same, roughly the same quantity up to a constant and slightly different units. But otherwise, this is a slightly different concept. In fact, you can tell whether something is uniformly distributed. We call it, if this is the case, we say that it's a uniform distribution. Your entropy is log the size of the sample space. It's maximal if and only if you have a random distribution, complete random distribution. Okay. So how familiar you guys are with this? Like, have all seen it in okay, it's variable. So let's have some just intuition what it is. For the bias coin, because I keep having to use it, we may as well write it down how much it is. H of x, just plug it into anything that will calculate this for you. It is 0.6469, roughly 0.469. Now, what I want to say is that it looks like a very biased coin. You most likely will get one instead of zero. The entropy is close to a half here. It's a function that goes really quickly away from zero when you have a little bit of probability to be in anything rather than the definite state. One thing to note. So the next thing we want to cover is typical sequence. The event xn is, we call it delta typical. If now here, the random variable x and the number of draw n are already fixed. After we do that, we define what is delta typical. It is delta typical if we calculate this quantity, minus 1 over n log the probability of this event. You fix it, you calculate this thing. If it is delta close to the entropy, then it is delta typical. So remember, the motivation is that we think most of this has to be very close to the entropy when n is large. So when it is delta close, then we collect all of them and we call them all being delta typical here. Okay? You just have a name for these particular events. I'm off by one line, so what I will do is to remove this. And then define the typical set. The sequence go like this. Try to use the same notation throughout. I call it T for typical. N and delta is already specified. It's the set of all events that are typical with the parameter delta. So we'll see one example for a typical set. Start from this side. So back to the example for the bias coin. I just, for the sake of it, pick n to be 100. It is not a small number. It's not very big either. I picked delta being 0.1. So these are fairly, it's not very asymptotic, but let's see what happened with these choices to illustrate what these are. If there are T zeros and n minus t, 100 in this case for n, ones in xn, then you can just calculate minus log minus 1 over n log p of x n. You just do the calculation, you get minus t over n log 0.1 minus n minus t over n log 0.9. Just by noting that this is just 0.1 to the power t, multiply 2.9 to the power m minus t. So you take the, you just physically check this quantity. Now this is in, this quantity is in the interval. Now we want to write down h of x minus delta and h of x plus delta to be the interval for which if they fall into that interval, then it is typical. So we calculated that entropy earlier is 0.469. So this is 0.369 and 0.569. So this range of minus 1 over n log p of x will make p of x typical. That's from the definition. So we do the calculation. What these things are? It turns out if you just, it's a fairly simple equation to solve. T should be within 7 and 13 inclusive. If you want it to be typical, the average number of zeros should be 10 for the problem. Because we have 100 jaws and zero come up upon one probability. So it is 10 plus or minus 3 zeros. That's how much more you allow for the variation inside the set. So that's one example of the of a typical set. Now the second thing is that we will slowly see to that the typical set is a large probability set. So let's just also take a look at how large this set is in this example. Without boring you the exact calculation, let's just write it down. The calculation is in the notes. So the probability of this set, I'll use the notation T100.1, it is 75.897% roughly. That's pretty high. How many things are there if you calculate it? It's not that small, to be fair. It's roughly 8.3 times 10 to the power 15 elements in there. But that is compared to the sample space, which is 100 bits. If you do the calculation, that is roughly 1.3 times 10 to the power 30. So our set that has 76% of the probability is 1 over 10 to the power minus 15 in terms of population of the set. This number divided by that is basically zero. It's rather hilarious if you think about what's going on here. When you see something like this, you should really just try to prove it up to all the epsilon delta you can put down. But it is true. I mean, there's no gimmick or anything. It just happened that our intuition is not very good with large numbers and probability in general. So there's no gimmick around. So where am I?
Okay, this is some clean boards as well.
Oh. Oh, I see. There are quite a few. Oh, this is the fixed one. I see. Okay. Right. Good. Now I have to keep this board. Yes.
How do we know what is the reasonable delta?
Delta would depends on your precision.
Precision for what?
Precision on how typical you want your events to be. So if you want things to be really, really close, you want things that have probability really close to 2 to the minus n times entropy, then delta will be much smaller.
What is the range of delta?
You can take anything. It can be anything from 0 to whatever you want. You can do the calculation. When delta is too large, it's useless. Your theorem is useless.
Yeah.
When delta is too small, you don't include enough things until n is large enough. And I'm just about to write down the board with all the quantifiers there. It's going to be a little painful to see, but let's see if it's worth it. Okay. So the AEP, say for the writing. So for all, we haven't even talked about what is epsilon yet. Choose your epsilon, choose your delta. Then I go and pick an NNOC such that, because we say for large enough N, right? How large is large enough? So let's get that sorted out as well. Such that for all N bigger than or equal to NNOC, we have the following. Three properties. The first, the probability of your set, your typical set, as defined on that side of the board, is at least 1 minus epsilon. The second property is that your set is this big. It's at least as big as 1 minus epsilon times 2 to the n hx minus delta. That's the lower bound on how many things are in there. Oh, I write too big. Okay. Then there is the other side. So 2 to the n h of x. So the leading term is the same for the upper and lower bound. In this case, we put a plus here. And in the lower bound, we have the addition, 1 minus epsilon in the front. So you know how big this set is. It's roughly 2 to the n hx, but with the plus or minus delta around. To be fair, I hope one of you catch me. The minus or plus delta is multiplied to the n and then taken in the exponent. So they are very different in a way, but they're also not very different in a different way. And you know how different and how not different they are. Because I have all the epsilon delta written down. And if you want them to be very similar, you can pick delta very small. Now you see what you pay for. If you pick delta very small, then N naught has to be really big. So your effect will only come for much larger samples, a much larger number of samples. But you can pick any delta, however small you want. I find an NNOC, so that when N is bigger than that, I get all these three properties satisfied. So I'll say the rest in words. This is the large probability property. This is the small size effect. Because whenever HX is not the same as log the sample space, then you have a deficit from the maximum entropy. And if you treat delta to be small enough, then you definitely is smaller than that. I forgot the third one. The third one is also quite interesting. It turns out you can't do much better. You can't find large probability sets that are much smaller than that. Take any set that has large probability. So instead of the typical ones, you can start to collect the most likely event. If the probability of this set is at least 1 minus epsilon, then this implies the next statement. Then the size of this set A has to be at least 1 minus 2 epsilon, 2 to the nhx minus delta. So it's almost the size of the set we have found with a 2 here. That's the only difference. So you can't find much smaller set than what we have. Of course, you can find something smaller. Think about the coin, the bias coin, right? These are not the things that come out to be roughly between 7 and 13 zeros are not the most likely events. You should pick the all ones event. That is the most likely one. So if you want a large probability set that has very few elements, you should collect the largest, the most likely event in there. But you're not doing much better in terms of the dependence on N. That's the claim here, okay?
What is the probability of a set?
The probability of a set is the sum of the probabilities of the elements in the set. Yeah, these sets are subsets of our so we draw that thing n times, say, for example. So we are looking at n tuples of events. So everything I'm thinking about is in omega n times. And so every element in there has a well-defined probability. So subsets of this has a well-defined probability induced by the probability of the elements. Any further questions? You should feel comfortable asking because I'm talking to a slightly different audience than what I usually will be teaching in the math faculty in Waterloo. Okay, so good. But it is really a nice little piece of mathematics because it is all elementary, we'll see. I won't show you one of the inequality, but it's also easy to prove on your own. So next board. So I need to keep that around to make sure that I don't forget until I finish proving all parts of it. So next board is that one. So proof of the first statement we put there. So we apply the law of large number, I'll just write it in acronym, on the random variable y, which is equal to log p of x. Now written in this form is exactly what we talked about there, that the probability of small y equals to log p of small x is p of x. So that defines a new random variable based on the original one. So the expectation of y is exactly, I have the minus sign that I'm missing, huh? Let me take this as the random variable so that I get rid of the minus sign most of the time, so that the expectation of y is minus h of x. Okay? It's not going to cause me any problem, so I'll leave it that way. So now, the first thing to realize is that since xn is iid, if you draw y n times, it is also iid. Your y1 is independent of y2. Let you convince yourself of that. Because y1 depends only on x1, y2 depends on x2, and x1 and x2 are drawn independently. So y1 and y2 are not going to be dependent on one another. We need that. So now, the same notation as before, we have xn being x1 through xn small, and this is one of the events that we're interested in the original problem. We call yi equals to log p x small x xi. Then what I want to do is to phrase the fact that xn is not typical if and only if certain things about the random variable y happen. So we'll write that. And we'll use this repeatedly. Xn is not in the typical set if and only if my empirical average for y is at least delta far from the expectation. We saw that on the previous plot earlier, but we want a very airtight proof written down, so we wrote it once here. And I call this the property star. So basically, to prove part one, we want to bound the probability that this right-hand side fails. Like, we want to bound the probability of the right-hand side, sorry. So to do this, we use one of these large deviation bound in probability. So let's keep that one up there because we're still using the intuition. This. They actually actually many, many forms of the law of large number. I'm just taking one of these easy to prove large division bound. So we use Q bound. The probability of the right-hand side of star. We use this inequality called Chebyshev's. Inequality for a random variable. Now, because I want to write down just a blank lemma or theorem for a different random variable, just call it Z here, and then we'll find out what it is for our purpose, and we'll plug the values in. And anyone who wants to see the proof, I can show you offline, have it in a few lines here. So the probability over the outcome C, small c, that happened to be different from the average, more than k times the square root of the variance of this random variable. So this is an event on its own that you draw Z according to the distribution of Z, the random variable Z, and it's that far from the expectation, happened with probability at least this much. This itself happens with probability no bigger than 1 over k squared. The variance, should I say what it is, or it's obvious? The square root of the variance is the standard deviation of the random variable. So I'll just say tell it that way. So it says that it is so many standard deviation from the mean for your outcome. And this does not happen very often. And it's 1 over how many standard deviation you have from it. It's a very weak statement, in fact. There are much sharper bounds, but this one you can prove within a few lines. So suppose you already know this, then how do we prove what we want to prove? So if we eyeball the problem, we want to bound the probability of this thing. So we set this to be Z. In fact, it's the outcome, so I will use small alphabet Z. This is then, we have to find out what, we have to match EY to EC in a bit. So let's say that choose the random variable Z to be 1 over N, sum over I equals to 1 through N, YI itself. So we now have yet another random variable. YI is already derived from the XIs. And now we mix Z to be the average of the YI. We are allowed to keep defining random variables on top of previous random variables. We're allowed to, it's just math. So when we do that, then small z will indeed be the thing that we want to bound in the expression there. Now, most importantly, the variance of z will then be 1 over the variance of y. Because the yi's are independent, when we have that, then when we sum over independent random variables, then we get that extra factor of 1 over n in the variance. So we do that, we choose k. Now we want to prove that, right? So we want to eyeball how to get the proof through. So we want this to be delta. So we choose k such that k times the variance of C is equal to delta, which says that K is delta over square root variance of Z, and which we already know. X is known, so we can calculate variance of Y. N is known, we just saw the calculation through, and then you find what K is. So finally, what should we pick for N? We want to find N such that the whole thing happened with probability no bigger than epsilon. That's what the ultimate goal of the proof is, right? So what we want is that this is no bigger than epsilon. Okay, so we set n such that space here, 1 over k squared is no bigger than epsilon. And then we explain what that means. So we have what K is supposed to be here. So rewriting K in this form, we have K, we have variance Z over delta square, no bigger than epsilon, which is the same as from this relation here, variance of Y over N, delta square is no bigger than epsilon. So if we pick N up to make this hold, which means that if N naught is equal to epsilon, oh, the other way around, of course, is variance of Y divided by N delta square epsilon. If we choose it that way, and of course we take the ceiling just in case, then the first statement will hold. We have done this in a few steps. So what I have done is to pick N to be at least this big so that the rest of the recipe I need in the Shepard-Scherf inequality will hold. So that when I plug everything back in, I know that this thing happened with probability at most 1 minus epsilon. And because these two things are if and only if, so the probability of this side also happened with at most probability at most epsilon itself. Should I bother writing down the one or two last lines for the proof? Or yeah, it's pretty clear. How we get it. I know that the trick, I mean, the work is in proving Shepard-Scherf inequality, but as I said, it is rather elementary, so I let you either look it up online or because I have other things that I want to cover in this lecture. So, but as promised, this basically comes from the law of large number. You sum a bunch of things together, you take the average, you sample something independently, you look at the average, it has to be roughly the average of the random variable. So, good. This is probably the longest proof in the lecture. Then we have two other things to prove before the break. So now, knowing this, why does it give us this other result? Why this set is so small? Why it cannot be bigger? I want to keep that board alive. Maybe I'll write underneath it. So the first thing I'll write down here is quite obvious. So we just proved this. This set has probability at least 1 minus epsilon. It is obvious that the probability of this set cannot be bigger than 1. So now, furthermore, I can write the probability of the set according to the definition. We take everything that is in the set and we sum the probability of these elements. Okay? So far, nothing has happened. Now, the next thing is to upper and lower bound this expression. Everything is in the typical set, so nothing is more probable than 2 to the minus n h of x. Because of the minus sign here, we put the minus sign here to make the most likely element in the parentheses here. So this is the highest probability of any typical element. And I should multiply by the size of the typical set. Okay. Likewise, it cannot be too low either. The minimum probability to be in the set is this. And you multiply that by the size of the typical set. So far we have done a few steps that are basically tautology of what we already know. Now, next we get the bound that we want to show in there. We put together these two inequalities. Because it's equal in the middle, we can chain them up. So we get that the size of the typical set cannot be smaller than 1 minus epsilon 2 to the n hx minus delta. Yeah, because of the thing in the middle. So we put these together, and then you just move this factor to the other side. The other side is simpler. It is similar. We take these two inequalities together and then move this factor to the other side. So we also have that. The size of the typical set is no bigger than 2 to the n hx plus delta, as promised. So that's the second part. The third part, good, I'm making good time. So we consider any set in the space of event, and it has the property that we hypothesized. It has probability at least 1 minus epsilon. For the sake of writing fewer symbols, I just call my typical set T, and everyone likes these kind of diagrams. So the thing on the left is A, the thing on the right is T. Okay, now let's analyze what happened to the probabilities here. The probability of the intersection can be written as a difference between the probability of the this set A minus this bit here. So that is A, but not in T. Okay? Now, this cannot be bigger than PA minus. So what I'm going to do is to make this line smaller, right? So I'm going to expand A to the rest of the space. It can only make this probability bigger, and I subtract it, so I got my inequality that way. And this, we know, is never bigger than epsilon. So if I replace it by epsilon, I subtract more. So that is the right inequality. And this is by itself at least 1 minus epsilon. So I get my 1 minus 2 epsilon here. The next thing is that we're going to prove a very similar trick than before. Let me just finish this in one line. The size of A is of course bigger than the size of A intersect T. It's not arguable. And this is at least the probability of A intersect with T divided by, now we want this to be a lower bound for that, so we pick the maximum probability of the set. Max over A in A intersect T, P of A. But since we already take the intersection with the typical set, this cannot be bigger than the most likely element in the typical set. So we can make the further replacement. P of A and T divided by 2 to the, so we want the most likely element, so we have a minus in front of the delta. Right. So that's what we have there. And this we just upper bound to lower bound to be 1 minus 2 epsilon. And I flip this up, so 2 to the n hx minus delta as promised. So that's how big that large probability set has to be. So far we everything is two steps from elementary at most. And we finished proving these three things. Let's see. Well, I haven't finished the classical part. Let's take a break a little early. Is that okay? And we resume 10 past 3.